we have brilliant and wonderful scientists at Belmont, and any of them would have been delighted to do an address and could have done a wonderful address. But we decided to do a change-up pitch, as Bob, Kaida, and I spoke, and bring in someone from another discipline who can help us think very deeply about the idea of creativity and invention. Jeff Cornwall is the inaugural holder of the Jack C. Massey Chair in Entrepreneurship and Professor of Entrepreneurship here at Belmont. He holds a doctorate in business administration and an MBA from the University of Kentucky. In the 1980s, he left academics for a 9-year stint as co-founder, president, CEO of Atlantic Behavioral Health Systems. And I told Jeff when I came here that I owed my job to him, because as I was being interviewed, I kept referencing what I'd read about him, the fact that he had taken a brilliant business mind, had looked at the need of children with a range of disabilities and challenges in their lives, and had created, really ex nihilo, this wonderful system to serve them. And he is a person of deep Christian faith and was motivated by his faith to do something to make the greatest difference in the world. And I kept quoting him, and when I got the job, I told him, I said, it's thanks to you, because that's what characterizes, in my mind, how we can live out our faith through our work. He served as president of the United States Association of Small Business Entrepreneurship. He's received many national awards, including just this year being the National Entrepreneurship Educator of the Year. And he has led our entrepreneurship program to heights unimagined. We have a lot of numbers we in academia throw around, you know, like Belmont is number 7. And we like our applicants to think like number 7 in the world or in the country. You know, we're number 7 comprehensive master's institution in the Southeast. It's a claim to fame, but it's not the Sorbonne, right? Jeff has led the entrepreneurship program to be ranked in the top 20, period. No asterisks, no footnotes. The top 20, one of the top 20 entrepreneurship programs in the country. He's published 8 books. Is it 8 or is it 9 now? 9 now, okay? I haven't seen him in a few days. He writes an award-winning blog called The Entrepreneurial Mind. Forbes named it a best of the web blog. It's syndicated by the Christian Science Monitor, among others. He also writes a bi-weekly column for the newspaper of record for our state, the Tennessean. He is going to speak to us for about 40 minutes or so, and then we'll open up the floor for questions, which he warmly invites. Let's give a very warm welcome to Dr. Jeff Cornwall.
The problem with an introduction like that is it's going to be downhill from there. I'm sorry to say that. Thank you, Todd, very much, and thank you, Bob, for inviting me to be here. I have to admit it was a little bit of a curiosity why they'd want an entrepreneur to come and talk to a group of scientists. But Todd explained the method to his madness, and it sounded intriguing like me, and I'm an entrepreneur, so I like to take risks, so here I am. I'm going to be talking to you about, tonight about my journey. And it's not just my entrepreneurial journey. It's also my journey of faith. And it's my journey as a Christian, making my way through a world that is sometimes not welcoming to people of faith in terms of practicing their faith. Not unlike, I'm sure, what many of you have experienced as scientists trying to practice your faith in academia. In business, we face some of the same challenges. My journey is one of both being an entrepreneur, which I've been on and off for almost all my life, but also as someone who came to faith as an adult and who has tried even to this day, to, as we all do, to continue to build that faith. But more so, it's a journey of trying to be one of integrity. It's one of trying to bring these two things together. And it's a journey with some stumbles and some detours and some speed bumps along the road. But it's a journey that I hope to share a little bit tonight. Business faculty, I'm a business professor. I was an administrator until June, and now I'm just a chump faculty again, and happy as can be. That's why I have that ninth book out. I had time on my hands again. So, business professors, we teach with stories, we teach with experiences, we teach with examples and cases, and so that's why I'm choosing to do this tonight for you. Not so much to try and puff up my story at all, but to really use that as a vehicle to explain how I got to where I am. I started out as an entrepreneur. I was raised with this stuff at the dinner table. My dad was an entrepreneur, my grandfather was an entrepreneur, and so I was destined to do this. I had that kind of wiring in my brain, and it was something that I started at a very young age. I got involved with family businesses, did some things on my own, but eventually made the decision to move into academia. I came into academia somewhat by accident. I decided I wanted to get an MBA. I got an MBA at a period of time when 1980, some of you look gray enough to remember 1980, and it was not a very good time to come out with an MBA in finance, and literally couldn't find a job. And so ended up sticking around the university and getting a doctorate and taught for a few years. I enjoyed teaching, and I enjoyed that craft. I was at a state university, and quite honestly, that was a frustration for me in terms of some of the parts of my journey that I'm going to be talking about. But I stayed there for about 6 years, got tenure, and quit. Like I said, I like to take risk. Decided to go into business with a couple of people, and so went out to North Carolina and started this company called Atlantic Behavioral Health. It was the early days of managed care. It was a very frightening time in terms of health care for some people, but for people like me, it was a very exciting time because it was a time when all the rules were changing and everything was broken, and we could really reinvent and help reinvent an industry. And in our case, in a small way. But we could help that reinvention process. I was very careful who I went into business with. That was one of the things I had learned the hard way from some experiences earlier in life, how important it is in terms of who you surround yourself with. And so both of my partners were people of faith, and both my partners and I committed ourselves to try and use our values and to use our faith to help form this business. Now, there wasn't a whole lot of help for this. There wasn't a whole lot written about this. There wasn't a whole lot of guideposts for this. So we did our best. We did our best to try and shape what we believe to be important values, most of which came from our faith, into the business practices and how we did things in everyday life. So we built it into our employee practices. We tried to do things in terms of good wages. We tried to do things in terms of job security, which in healthcare at that time was unheard of. But we were committed to that. And so we tried to do that. And it came from our commitment that we believed came from our own faith journeys. We also didn't get much help from clergy. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I will say that most of the priests in the Catholic Church have not had experience to be able to really relate to the kind of journey that we were on. And so in a lot of ways, we were kind of left on our own. In a lot of ways, we ended up being often quite confused as to what to do. Now remember, we're taking risk. Remember, this is the kind of experience where you don't know if you're going to get paid next week. And you don't know if you're still going to be open next month. Literally, that was the case. Literally, that was the case of what we did. And yet, we tried to always have integrity. We tried to be true to what we had committed to ourselves and our employees and our customers. But I'll tell you, I stumbled a few times along the way. We all do. One of the times I think we finally got it right, and it was this kind of epiphany for me in terms of really the responsibility that I had as an entrepreneur, was when we had this person come along called an angel. This is something that came out of Forbes magazine, their attempt to depict what's called an investment angel. If you're not familiar with that term, this is an extremely rich individual who invests directly in growing companies. And we were a fast-growing company at this time. And so he's investing his own personal money into this. And I was sitting there at closing. I was sitting there at the closing of this investment. He was going to put $1 million into the business. And I had this vision of him coming in with one of those great big checks like they have on television. But he came in like he always did, in blue jeans and a flannel shirt. And he sat down at the table, a wonderful gentleman. He was one who also had a strong faith, and that was something that was important to us. We said no to some other money along the way because we didn't feel those people were going to be consistent with how we wanted to do our business. But this man, we felt, would be. And he sits down at the table, and he pulls out of the back pocket of his blue jeans a checkbook. Now, I have to explain what a checkbook is to my students these days because most of them don't know what that is. And it was a very traditional checkbook. It was like one of those cheap plastic covers that you get free from the bank. And he had some free pre-printed checks. This guy was worth $120 million. And I'm going, okay, he's got blue jeans, tennis shoes, and he has this really cheesy looking checkbook that he's pulling out. And he starts to write, pay to the order of Atlantic Behavioral Health, $1 million. Now the check looks something, I don't have the exact check, but it looks something like this. Isn't the internet wonderful? You can find almost any image you want out there. It was a little bit different than that, though. It was even cheesier than that check. There was actually one of these three-dimensional fences that kind of come out at you and gets really big up in the front. And I remember this vividly. There was a bluebird sitting right about here where he finished the word million. But what I was drawn to was up in the upper left-hand corner there. It was his name. It was his wife's name. It was his home address. It was his home phone number. And this man was entrusting us. Yes, he was rich, but he was entrusting us with a lot of money. And it was money that he wrote that check, and he knew he may never see it again. And it was at that moment that I really, I think for the first time, understood truly what it meant to be a steward as an entrepreneur. And I had felt it at other times. I had felt it early on when people came to work for us and risked their careers and trusted us with their labors to be able to pay them. That certainly was humbling. That certainly gave me a sense of stewardship. But there was something about that bluebird sitting there underneath that word million that hit me hard and made me realize the responsibility, the stewardship I had to this man. I thought about the stewardship I have in terms of being a Christian, but this brought it to life. This, for the first time, helped me really understand this integration, that it's no different in terms of stewardship, in terms of what we do to praise God and what we do for our fellow man, be he rich or poor. So that was a remarkable experience for me. It was one where it really started to get me to be humbled in terms of what people were entrusting me with, their labor, their time, their money, their careers, and patients were trusting us doing new kinds of treatment no one had ever done before and giving us their children to make well. The second time that I really felt the impact of this kind of practical, everyday living of your faith journey and having to deal with this issue of stewardship came when we sold the business. We had several opportunities to sell the business, and where we would have quite honestly made a lot more money. But every time we kind of looked at where this was going to take the business after we were left, we wanted to ensure that what happened after our days, we felt good about that direction, or as good as one could, handing something over to someone else. And quite frankly, we just said no to a few things that, we knew were not going to at all be consistent with how we wanted our employees treated going forward, how we wanted our patients treated going forward. It was not going to be something consistent with what we had built. Now, it was time for us to sell. One of the questions I often get is, well, then why did you even sell if this is so important to you? One of the things about very dynamic markets is there comes a point in time where the structure of an industry changes fundamentally. We may face that from what some people are telling us in higher ed in the not-too-distant future. And it was going on in healthcare. And we knew we couldn't survive as kind of a smaller player that had chosen to intentionally stay smaller to keep that culture, to keep that approach. The world had changed, and we could no longer ensure our survival. We were doing fine. We were doing well. And we were trying to continue to do good, but we weren't sure how long that could continue. So we wanted to find a good home. If it had to get into a bigger system, we wanted to get into a bigger system that we felt confident and comfortable that it would be a good outcome. Again, this notion of stewardship. One of the things I also bumped up against at this point in time was a much more personal sense of stewardship. You know, we are stewards of our bodies and our gifts that, God has given us. And quite frankly, this is where I've learned from the theologians why they talk about how messy virtues are. They were once described to me as a bowl of just wonderful soup, and you can't really pick out which one you're dealing with at the particular time. They all kind of work together. And the one that was bumping up against stewardship for me was my nemesis, temperance. I'm a workaholic. I have always had that problem. That's why I am often writing two or three books at a time. That's why I'm doing things I shouldn't do. I love to work. But part of what happens when you let yourself indulge in something that, you take to excess, it starts to impact your body, your health, and I was not being a good steward of me. So when we sold the business, I came down literally the next morning after we had closed, and I came bouncing down to the breakfast table, and my wife said, well, what are you going to do next? And I said, I'm going to start another company. I'm going to start a healthcare informatics business. It's going to be fabulous. What could possibly go wrong? I've got the money. I've got the team. It's going to be great. Now, I had had a mini stroke about 6 months before. Talk about stewardship of one's body. And it was stress-induced. And my wife said, that's nice, dear, but you're in timeout. I said, timeout? She said, yes, you're in timeout. No deals for 6 months. This is a direct quote. If she was here tonight, she'd be in the back nodding. She was going to come, but we've got one of our baby granddaughters with us, so I don't think that would be such a good deal. So here I was faced with this notion of what do I do next? What do I do with my gifts? She wasn't letting me do what I was driven to do. But as I began to understand after about a long period of time, her wisdom was that it helped me understand what I was called to do as a steward of my gifts. And it took a little time to get there. It was about 4 or 5 months into my time out, and we were sitting at the breakfast table, and she said, have you ever thought about going back in academics? I said, no, academics, no. They just fight over copier budgets and classrooms, and I can't possibly do that. I'm an entrepreneur. I run companies. She goes, okay, that's nice. About 2 weeks later, I came down to the breakfast table and I said, "Honey, I got a great idea. I think I might go back into academics." Women are wise. And so I made that decision to go back into academics. I felt that calling. I felt that, yes, I could go and I could make another pile of money. Money's not bad. It's just what we do with money, and it's our lust for money that gets bad. But we didn't really need that in our lives. And it was clear that I was being called to do something else, and that was to teach. That was to work with young entrepreneurs and to help this generation that's very entrepreneurial hopefully get it right. So that's how I ended up back in academics. Now, my first stint was at a place called the University of St. Thomas. No, not the island. This is in Minnesota, in St. Paul, Minnesota. I didn't realize how cold it gets in St. Paul, Minnesota. But we went up there, and it was a wonderful entrepreneurship program, and it was a wonderful faith-based university. It was an incredible 6 years that I had at that place, and I'm forever grateful for that time, because it really helped me in my journey. It helped me it challenged me like I've never been challenged to understand this notion of integration of work and faith. Business people really suck at that. We're awful at that. We're great about going to church on Sunday, and then Monday morning, it's a completely different set of rules. No holds barred. We as business people are challenged by that hypocrisy. And so to have the opportunity to work at a university and now at a second university that allows me to kind of not only work on that journey myself but to help others has truly been a blessing, and I'm forever grateful. Early on in my time at St. Thomas, I participated in this event that they called the Catholic Intellectual Tradition. Now, really, it was Christian intellectual tradition. It was much broader than just Catholic scholars. They drew from all sorts of Christian scholars, and what they did was they offered this not as a requirement, but as a voluntary kind of thing for faculty to do. And they'd have one for business faculty, they'd have one for science faculty, they have one for faculty in the arts, and so forth. And I went to the one they did for business faculty. Now, most of these were like a half a day. But the business one was like 5 days. I think they felt we had a little bit more to kind of overcome in terms of this. So we went on this retreat, and it was an eye-opening experience for me. For the first time, I started to understand and have some frame for these things that my partners and I struggled with and I had struggled with. And it started to make sense to me, some of the things that we tried to do and a few things we did okay, and some of the things we probably could have done a lot better. And it was a wonderful experience. And partway through that event, I made a friendship with a guy. Randy was talking about how diverse this group is. I guess you'd have to call me a libertarian from the North Woods of Wisconsin kind of a guy. I'm that's kind of my frame of reference. I don't like things big. I don't like big businesses. I don't like anything big. And so my teaching partner, the theologian, was a Catholic theologian, obviously, from the south side of Chicago, whose dad and uncle and grandfather and brothers were all union bosses in Chicago. And so sparks flew for a little while. But what was remarkable was, as we started to work together and then started to teach together, we actually had the privilege of team teaching a capstone course for business students integrating faith and entrepreneurship, we began to realize how much common ground we really had. We got past the petty little things we loved to fight and argue about. There was so much we had in common. Now, the students loved the fights. Students loved when we'd sit up there and argue, because then they didn't have to contribute that day. They could sit back and watch, and we'd be going back and forth. But it got to the point where we taught this course a few more times. We actually had to kind of create those arguments and contrive those, because we had really come to understand each other so well, coming from very diverse backgrounds. I'm not a trained theologian by any stretch, and he is certainly not a trained business person. And yet, we found a way to help these entrepreneurship students, and later to help entrepreneurs in their quest to integrate their faith and their work. And that's what we tried to end up doing together. Now, one of the first big questions that we asked, we academics love to ask big questions, and our first big question that we really explored together was what is really entrepreneurial success? Now, most of us think it's things like, you know, revenue growth and profit growth and how big we get in terms of the number of employees, and certainly those are metrics. But for many entrepreneurs, as we started to study them and listen to them and learn about their own journeys, we were amazed at how many entrepreneurs define their success in terms of much higher purposes. Now, they didn't always frame them that way. They thought they were just doing the right thing. But we were blown away by how committed they were to the right thing and how inspiring they were and how creative they were in doing that right thing. It was an amazing experience to see these entrepreneurs in action really integrating and living their faith in every day, the little things they did in their business and the big things they did in their business. So that big question led us to really starting to look at how the role of virtue comes to play in defining success. We believe that virtue helps move beyond sort of the narrow focus of technical competence, those financial goals. Now, that's necessary, but it's certainly not sufficient. And yet, if we think about how we train business people, if we think about how we train scientists, in our classrooms, we often kind of get lost in the technical. And we forget about the importance of those bigger questions of why and for what purpose and how we define success. It helps us move beyond self-centered approaches, and in business, that's rampant. There's a reason we get regulated so much. It's because there's a lot of really greedy, self-centered people in business. And that's sad. And as someone who doesn't like big things, I would much rather we didn't have to have big things keeping an eye on that so closely. And yet we do, sadly. And so that's one of the things that we've been trying to do is hopefully lead a discussion that someday may get us more to the point where people act from within instead of acting because of fear from what's going to happen outside. It also helps us define the importance of stakeholders in terms of our success. So our employees, our investors, our community. Trust me, when you open up a facility for severely mentally ill kids, the neighbors are going to get a little bit nervous. That's a scary thing to bring into even a rural community, which is where we built most of our facilities. It's scary to think that you're going to have 80 severely mentally ill kids living a mile down the road. And so we really tried as owners to focus on building good relationships and right relationships with the community. We always had community advisory boards. Whenever anything bad happened, the first people to know about were the neighbors, and we let them know what we were doing, and we developed enough trust where some of the most opposed neighbors to our project ended up coming and playing basketball and being mentors to the kids. It was a remarkable transformation. Now, as we started to look at virtues, one of the things that we kind of came to, especially for dealing with students, was we wanted to have a framework that was approachable to them. And we were drawn to the four cardinal virtues. Their simplicity and yet their power was something that spoke to us and for me as an entrepreneur, spoke to a lot of what I experienced as an entrepreneur. I talked a little bit about my intemperance. And prudence is certainly a big part of what we looked at in terms of this whole notion of stewardship. So Mike Naughton is my co-author. He and I wrote a series of papers about these different virtues and how they come to play for business owners and business people and managers and what it means in everyday practices and work to help them understand and think about these things. prudence is concerned not only with what is right, but also that is done rightly. As, again, I'm not a theologian, and except for Todd, I think you're the only theologian in the room, probably. Some of these things took me a while to kind of understand the real implication of what we did. Prudence is not only looking at what is good, but that it is done well. Entrepreneurial prudence has three components, is what we discovered as we went on our own intellectual journey that was driven by our faith journey. First of all, careful stewards as entrepreneurs and stewards in general in this world understand that the resources they have available are precious, they're a gift, they're not theirs, and they have a responsibility to their fellow man and to God to take good care of what's been given to them. And also, prudence involves the pursuit of morally good ends. And we're going to talk in just a minute about this relationship of means and ends, and that it's they're linked inextricably together. But also, and this is the part where the pragmatist in me came through, you have to deal with the circumstances. One of the things I tell business ethicists is they like to make things sound so simple. Maybe it's true in scientific ethicists too. It's rarely black and white. That's the easy stuff. It's the gray stuff. It's those circumstances that are really struggling with that make for difficult decisions. So prudence involves means, ends, and circumstances. Talk just a minute about the means. And we talk about this in terms of the art of entrepreneurial skills, and not just technical skills, but skills that are informed by this virtue. We always like to start this discussion with our students, and I do it with entrepreneurs who I work with as well, and kind of take them all the way back to Genesis and tell them, you know, look, God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. Each of us is made in God's image, and each have been given command to have dominion to make something. We all continue God's creation in what we do every day. And I think sometimes we lose focus and lose our sense of purpose in terms of what that is that we really do. For the entrepreneur, this is really taking the stuff that you guys come up with. You're the smart ones. You're the ones who come up with these amazing patents and inventions and discoveries. We're just the guys, the front men, who go out and try to figure out how to put them to use. We have the easy part. That's what we do. That's our work. Our work is to take the important things that people like you discover and find a way to make them accessible and available to all. That's really what the essence of being an entrepreneur is. One of the important things that we teach, and when I use the word bootstrapping in here, knowing that you guys do a lot in statistics, we're not talking about the statistical technique of bootstrapping here. This is business bootstrapping, and business bootstrapping is this amazing thing that entrepreneurs have learned to do to be able to start and grow a business when they have limited resources. And that's what we teach here at Belmont. We don't teach them to go out and raise boatloads of money if they don't need boatloads of money, because that money corrupts. One of the biggest mistakes I made was raising that $1 million. Nice man. I had good intentions. But we really didn't need the money. We raised it because we could. And there were times where we became, even as much as I was thinking of that little bluebird under the word million, where I know we became less than prudent, not good stewards, because we had more than we needed. God's creation is not a one-time event. It's an unfolding process. And so it unfolds in everything that we do every day. And the constant question for all of us is whether we participate in and this call for collaboration with God or frustrate God's created order through our self-interested order. Boy, I wish I had read that sentence 30 years ago when I first went into business. Because I think for me, that when Mike, I wish those were my words, the eloquent words you see here are the ones that Mike developed. I just tell the stories. And that was one of the things that Mike put to paper that just blew me away in terms of how simple and yet how powerful this notion is. In terms of ends, what kind of person is the entrepreneur becoming? There's an interesting process that goes on when we work. How we do our work, even in everyday things, becomes a habit. And habit becomes virtue. Enron, you all know, remember Enron and all those people, those poor stockholders. You know, they didn't show up one day, the executives in Enron, and said, "We're going to start lying and stealing from shareholders. That'd be a fun thing to do this week." That happened because they had made a series of decisions and actions over time that led to that becoming a habit. It's just how they acted. Is work moving the entrepreneur towards his calling in life? That was certainly something that, you notice my zigzag kind of journey in life. Getting to where you're called to be is sometimes difficult, and sometimes we kind of lose our way. How's our work impacting our family? That was one of the things that was really striking to me. Up until the time we sold our company, I was literally working 80, 90, 100-hour weeks. I didn't always have to. I just wanted to. And part of my time out allowed me to really get to know my family again. And in that process, I realized how much of my calling in life was to be a father and now a grandfather. What impact will our product or service have on the customer? This is a big one. This is one of the big arguments that comes into play on why business needs to be so tightly regulated. If we did a better job as business people thinking about the consequences of what we do, we wouldn't need the government to come in and watch us. But we don't. And sadly, they have to. And are we as entrepreneurs fostering a community of work? That's what we're called to do. We're called to be a community. You are a community. In our churches, we are communities. We should be a community in our work as well. Now, because we're academics, we had to figure out how to put all of this in a 2x2 matrix. Because that's what academics do. So, we looked at means and we looked at ends. We said, what happens in each one of these little blocks? How does this start to describe what happens? Well, if we have bad ends and ineffective means, we have an incompetent person and an incompetent entrepreneur, and those are the ones who go broke. I'm amazed at how many ineffective means, bad ends people I have met in my life, and a few I've had in my classes as well. If we have still ineffective means, but good ends in mind, we're certainly well-intentioned and we can be maybe called moralistic, but we're not going to be successful. Now, if we move to this other side, and we're very good at what we do, but we're seeking very bad ends, sadly, this is the stereotype of the entrepreneur that we see on television and out of Hollywood, and with, like, some other stereotypes in this world, there's just a grain of truth there. Well, in this one, there's a lot of truth, sadly. Where we're trying to get entrepreneurs to get to is this upper part of this 2x2 matrix, where they're both focused on the means and the ends. Good means, good ends. Again, not eschewing their financial responsibilities. That's over on the left side. You can have somebody who's great with their employees and tries to do the right thing, but if they can't run a business, it will fail. Finally, we need to link the ends and the means, and this is in the circumstances, and the prudent entrepreneur has to depend upon internal qualities of soul that are acquired through experience. Some of these qualities that help with this, and because you can't do this alone, is seeking wise counsel from others. As I said, this is a lonely journey for a lot of business people, and like you, I'm sure at times you feel isolated in your schools, and we did too, but I found ways to get connected to people who would call me on the carpet, who would say, Jeff, that's not you. That's not what you should be doing. You know better than that. And I found another group of CEOs, like-minded CEOs, and we spent a lot of time keeping each other honest. We need to also think through as much as possible future consequences, foresight. It's very easy to become impulsive when you're in a very difficult and dynamic situation. It's easy to make quick decisions in the moment and forget about the consequences of those. One of my wise counselors said, Jeff, your goal is to learn how to become a very good chess player, to think through the consequences of every move you make, no matter how small, and what it leads to. And display a certain degree of caution. That's really hard for me. I love risk. I love to start new things and do things. I have that driven impulsiveness of an entrepreneur, and it makes it very difficult to have that caution. I want to end. Don't you love it when the speaker gets to that point in the speech when he says, I want to end? Now, my pastor does something that means he has three more slides to go. This is the last one, I promise. There's often a story told of a medieval traveler who comes across three men constructing a building. The traveler asks the first man, what is he doing? And he replies, I'm building a wall. He poses the same question to a second builder who sighs with exhaustion and says, I'm putting food on the table and a roof over my family's head. Studs Terkel said, if work is so wonderful, why do they have to pay us to do it? And then the traveler came upon the third builder who responded, I'm building a cathedral for the praise and glory of God. I love the theme of this conference. It speaks to me. And when I heard that theme, I knew that as weird as it was to have an entrepreneur come talk to a bunch of scientists, that it made, at least in some strange way, some sense. So I want to thank you for your time and attention, and 38 minutes and 28 seconds. Lovely. And I'll be happy to take any questions. We have a little bit of time for Q&A if you have. Father, I don't hear well.
Okay.
Yeah, all right.
Who wants to start off?
I guess I'm the only thing between them and Lower Broadway, is that right? They know what Lower Broadway is? Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned a steering committee. How does a person go about finding individuals to help you?
In my world, she wanted to know what, you probably heard her fine, didn't you? Anybody not hear the question? She's speaking louder than I am. You must give lectures in a big hall, is that right? All right, so, they want the question on the tape. All right. So the question was, how do you pick people for this advisory board? How do you pick these counselors to help you in your business as an entrepreneur? I look for a few, very few different characteristics. First of all, they had to have a common set of values to me. Now, how those values become manifest, I'm not big on finding homogeneity in terms of that. I didn't have it in my partners. We certainly don't have that at Belmont. You probably don't have it in this organization. So I'm not talking about that we all go to the same church, sit in the same pew, and sing the same hymn. But we all had the same commitment to to Christ, to carrying on God's work, and the understanding that that's part of what we have to do in our business. So that's number one. The second thing I would do is try to find people who are as different from me beyond that as possible. Because it's in that diversity that I would get challenged. And so I had people from all different industries. I had people who washed uniforms for companies. I had a guy who had a trucking brokerage company. I had just a variety of people who we were mutual advisors. And so that diversity to me was very important. And I tried to find people as much as I could who were a lot older than me, because I've always been one to respect what can come from living and the lessons you can have along the way. And I have to like pizza, because I always had my meetings over pizza. Other questions? Yes, sir. So the question was about the role and the relationship between this fairly new phenomena in terms of at least a term called social entrepreneurship and more traditional entrepreneurship. If you've not heard the term social entrepreneurship, it's not what our students do at Daytona over spring break. That's not social entrepreneurship. Social entrepreneurship is an entrepreneur who pursues the process of entrepreneurship towards social ends rather than commercial ends. We have a separate major here at Belmont, both in entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship, but our programs are very tightly intermingled. And in fact, the social entrepreneurship kids take more entrepreneurship courses than they do social entrepreneurship courses. The social entrepreneurship courses they take help with them understanding the nonprofit world and some of the nuances that go into that whole arena. But beyond that, I don't see any difference. It's an interesting time because there's a lot of people from the traditional entrepreneurship world who are trying to stiff arm those people and say, that's not what we're all about. But I really think it is. And I really think the good entrepreneurs are on a continuum of social entrepreneurship. There's a fellow out of Duke who I love the way he talks about social entrepreneurship. He said it's not either being an entrepreneur or being a social entrepreneur. He said most of us are somewhere in the middle of that continuum or somewhere along that continuum. And I think if you have that attitude, I think you'll be both a better social entrepreneur, better technical skills, but I think you'll also be a better entrepreneur in terms of recognizing the higher purpose of what we're called to do. So I love the marriage that we've been able to achieve here on this campus. So, yes, ma'am. Yeah, I think a lot of what we try to do is certainly build a good foundation while they're here. And we really urge them to pay attention to advisory boards and pay attention and build a network of people that can sustain them in this sea. I have a lot of friends in the entertainment industry being here in Nashville, and one of the things that especially we have students that go off in the entertainment industry, and there's a lot of nasty stuff that goes on in the entertainment industry. And so even with them, we tell them, you know, surround yourself with like-minded people, with good people. We certainly do that. The other thing we do here at Belmont is we give them what we call our lifetime warranty. And we never take ownership in any deals. None of the faculty do. We never take a consulting dime from any of our alums and their businesses. We try to keep that mentorship relationship, that line available for them. And I spend an average of about 4 to 6 hours a week of my time with alumni and trying to help them. And a lot of the questions are around those kinds of issues. It's not the technical stuff. It's the how do I stay the right course and not stray? Or if I have strayed, how do I get things back? Yes, sir. I was afraid we'd get to the millennial question. All right. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is about the millennials, and we've found them to be a very entrepreneurial generation. But how do we kind of address that and work with them, and why they are that way? I've done a lot of thinking and writing about this topic because I've been fascinated by this change in generations. I came back into teaching with the Gen Xers, and I'm sure more than a few of you are Gen Xers out there, and that was one of the most non-entrepreneurial generations we've seen in a long time. There's a lot of angst. There's a lot of just not a lot of pursuit of risk-taking, and we actually see fairly low, even to this day, rates of entrepreneurship in that generation. The millennials, there has been a spike in entrepreneurial activity. I've not seen the last few years, but up until a few years ago, I was paying attention to the Chronicle survey of the incoming freshmen every year, and they have this one question they ask about, you know, what are your goals for going to school? And it's typically 40-45%. One of the goals that they cite is they want to own their own business someday. Now, that didn't exist when I went to college. I did, but I was considered kind of an oddball. In fact, I was actually encouraged to drop out of college. I was a good student. It wasn't anything about that. It was because, you know, they said, you know, are you going to become a merchant? You know, we don't train merchants here. We train corporate leaders of tomorrow. It was fairly unheard of, but my generation, the boomers, were the ones who've kind of felt the brunt of this economic turmoil that started way back in the 80s. I mean, this roller coaster ride we've been on in this economy goes way back, and our parents, the World War II generation, they raised us. You go to work for a company, you go there for 40 years, and you get your pension and you retire. And we're the first generation in a while that just got shattered. And so I think these kids, they're our kids, they're the boomers' kids, have been raised to distrust big institutions. And they do. Not just big corporations, but they distrust anything big. Even the social entrepreneurs distrust the big social entrepreneurial ventures out there. And so I think that's part of it. I think also part of it, we're finding that they're not quite as driven and ambitious. I don't know if you've noticed that, but more than a few end up going back and living with mom and dad and being perfectly comfortable with that. And you know, the typical answer, what are you going to do after college? Well, I don't know. I think I'm going to go to Europe for a little bit and hitchhike, and then I'll come back and hang out, and maybe I'll start looking for work next fall. I'm thinking, are you crazy? We're in the middle of a recession. It's been going on since 2008. There aren't that many jobs. You need to get out there. And then they get a job, and they quit. I had an email. Maybe you've all gotten this email. I had an email. Wonderful young girl. Great family. And she said, well, thanks for getting me that job, but it just wasn't for me. I wasn't felt like I was being challenged, and it wasn't pursuing my passion. I quit. This is a month after she started this job. And I said, do you have another job? She goes, no, I'm really at a quarter-life crisis. What in the world is a quarter life crisis? And so I hate to admit this out loud, but none of you are entrepreneurship professors, so I can say this to you guys. I think part of the reason they come to us is lifestyle. I think part of the reason they come to us in large numbers, and it's a misconception, it's a wrong reason, is they think that we can give them that kind of autonomy and freedom that they seem to want to have in their lifestyle. And we try to shatter that myth. We try to shatter it hard. Because even a simple little lifestyle business is wrought with risk and challenge and hardship. These kids have also been insulated from failure. I mean, they show up here with so much bubble wrap around them from their parents that it takes us weeks to unwrap that. And the parents show up for like a whole week of Towering Traditions here. I'm going, my dad barely slowed down the car enough for me to jump out when I went to college. So I think there's some cultural reasons. I think there's some economic reasons. And sadly, I think there's some really naive reasons why they're so drawn to this. Now, they are drawn. And what I'm trying to do, and a lot of people in my discipline are trying to do, is to get them to understand it and get enough of them to get it right, because Lord knows, we need their help. We need them to be successful. We're in a little bit of a demographic winter coming in this country. There's a lot of us with gray hair and bad knees and bad ears. Should I go on? All right. We're going to start comparing medications here in a minute. All right. So, and we need them. Because we don't have an engine in this economy right now. There ain't nothing driving it. And we need them to figure out what that's going to be. And so I'm a little more than a little bit worried that they're here, but they're not here for the right reasons. I love their idealism. I love their sense of rightness. And I think, so you asked what the church could do. I think the church is, at least for the kids here at Belmont, is doing great. Most of them seem to, you know, we are a different kind of a population than some universities, but we're fairly diverse now with the growth of professional programs and athletics and all of that, and we still seem to have a pretty strong community of faith, and I think it reinforces some of the kids. And that part of it I'm not as worried about as I am their motivation. Yes, sir. You have a couple.
And it struck me that what you're describing here from a faith-based approach is very similar to what could have been said of Joe Packard.
Yes.
Or a modern-day Google. We don't have any faith.
Yeah.
So do you see any threads that are pulled down in the same direction?
I honestly haven't looked at that question. That's interesting. You know, one of the things that I know a few of the people who were involved in Apple early on, and there was some real division on this whole issue at Apple. There were a couple of the early executives. In fact, we had one of them here on campus, who were people of deep faith, and yet Steve Jobs was an avowed atheist, and so, you know, I think there's battles in a lot of these institutions. I'll tell you though what happens, and this is kind of where this is why I hesitate to give much of a definitive answer. Something weird happens when a business goes public. It loses its soul, no matter what the soul. We may not have felt good in with Google's soul, being people of faith. But regardless of that, as someone who studies organizations, they lose their soul. They lose their soul because their objectives and their purpose changes. It's maximizing shareholder wealth instead of building a really cool place. No matter how much they say they still want to do that, they're maximizing shareholder wealth. And to do that, they start bringing in people who don't share whatever that original culture was. And they become very homogeneous and quite frankly, to me, very uninteresting. kind of places. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but that's I don't understand that beast. I've never worked in a public company. I'd probably last about a week in one, knowing me. I've only been an entrepreneur. I've been an academic. And thankfully, in academia, they can put up with some of my quirkiness sometimes. It's gone. Yeah, it would be gone. Eventually, there'd be enough pressure there where that would go away. Yeah. Going public's a weird thing, and I almost took my business public, and thank the Lord I didn't, and we didn't sell to a public company either because of that. I saw what happened to my friends who were entrepreneurs. And I saw what happened to their businesses, and they all looked alike. It's like you could go into any one of them, and they were alike. Yes, sir. Still feels weird after an hour, too, doesn't it? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right, right.
So, but as an entrepreneur, you have a responsibility to do basically the opposite. And so how does that kind of contrast between the academic world and the business world work for you going back to what you need to do and then work for your Christian faith?
All right, so the question is, I think, is, let me make sure I got this right. The question is that entrepreneurs like to hide what they do under a bushel basket. And as an academic, we want to share everything with everybody. Interesting, my experience says that the most successful entrepreneurs don't hide things under a bushel basket. I wanted everybody to see my practices. I wanted them to see what we did and how we did it. I had no trade secrets whatsoever. I guess I was raised old school, I guess. I believe that the success not comes from the idea, but the execution. And so we helped a lot of other seemingly competitors in our industry because I was convinced we could out-execute them any day. And I thought, by doing this, we're going to make a better industry. You had a question?
I guess it gets back to, do you think there's something fundamentally wrong with the public model and the course that we have to fundamentally change in order to get back to the Christian faith?
Yeah. There's not a lot of Christianity in the boardrooms of public companies. There's people of deep personal faith, but it doesn't go much beyond that. What do we do about that? When we ask those questions and we start to try to think of things that we do to control that or manage that, business people are very clever. And they find ways around everything when it's a rule. I think we have to change their hearts. I don't think we can impose. I don't think that never works. We have to do that at times as a stopgap, but it's never a permanent solution, I think. Yes, sir. Randy.
I wondered if you could comment on the distinction in between the creativity that's inherent in the scientific discovery process with the creativity that's unfolding the entrepreneurship of putting in that disease.
Yeah. I don't think they're different animals, and the question was, how do you compare and contrast the creative process of the entrepreneur with the creative process of the sciences? I don't think they're different, and I don't think they're the same, but I do think they're part of the same thing. And there's very very few true inventors who become entrepreneurs. Very few. There's, you know, we can put up a few like Edison and a few people like that, but a lot of times the best inventors can't get past that act of creativity. They can't, and there's been a lot of research on this. They can't kind of get to that next step of starting something. One of my friends refers to it as entrepreneurial ADD. They're too busy thinking about the next cool question to ask, and so they're constantly going sideways. That's oversimplifying what you do, because I know you guys do streams of research and work on that. But you're constantly asking new questions, and it's that inventive process that can take years that you do. So I think we're kind of that next step in the creative process, and our creativity doesn't hold a candle to your creativity, I don't think. That's why it's so cool to talk to a group like this, because you guys are the ones who loosen the soil and you make it fertile, and we come along and sprinkle a little water on it and go, see how smart we are and what we did. But it's part of the same process today. Bob? We use past tense. That's never good. That's never good when they use past tense.
Is that, in my field, in doing this kind of research, we're pretty blunt about it, you're scrambling research dollars for the next big thing that's trying to do. In this cutthroat research world, with limited funding.
Right. So maybe you're becoming more like us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
that's an excellent point. Thank you. No. That's all right. Yeah, that's all right. Yes, sir. Yes. Oh yeah. What can we do about it? So the question was that there, in the good old days, there used to be lots of toys and things we could play with and surplus military things and research projects for military and space and all that kind of stuff, and that's gone. And there's a real debate about what is cause and what is effect, but it's impacted both of our worlds very significantly, and it worries me tremendously, because you don't have the tools as scientists and as Bob was just saying, don't have the dollars, and that's if you go to the ultimate supply chain of what I do, you're the headwaters of that, and if that dries up, we're not going to be able to create big, new, bold